Of the pod bra.
It's fan cast.
Fan cast of the pod bra.
Man, I fucked that up big time.
Wow. Yeah, we should probably just start over the whole podcast. Delete all 150 episodes. Yeah. So I have a question for the pod.
Yeah. Ask.
This is a question from our listener and someone who engages with us a lot, Austin Almond.
Hey,
hi, Austin.
Hey, Austin. I'm reading this for the first time. Here we go. What is the most basic musical? Basic as in throwing shade, not basic as in like simple, but like what is the most like basic musical? And then I'll tell you what Austin said once y'all tell me.
My first thought
is obviously like Oklahoma, but then you go, no, because it's because of the time and when it was, you can't really say that. But that's, I have one, I know what it is, but I want to hear y'all's first.
I mean, I think it's because now we're getting ready to like launch into School of Rock next week. I'm thinking like there's so many musicals that have come out in the last decade that have been based on movies that came out 10 years before.
Sure.
That's because the first thing I thought was Bring It On, I guess, where it's like, this was a hit in theaters. Let's turn it into a musical. But
call it basic only for the fact that it has so much stunt work.
True.
Right.
Basic been kind of, I don't know.
But it's very clear that they have a musical cast and a cheerleader cast. It's not like they're like super multi-talented people.
There's some things. There's some things in Bring It On. We talked about. What's your answer, Scott? I have one.
Gosh, I just don't know. The most basic.
I've decided it's How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
I'd go with
I
that.
I don't know that one
sure,
very well.
Sure.
Because it's basic. That's why you don't know it.
It's basic. It is. It's a basic story. What was Austin's answer?
Okay, so Austin threw some shade. Austin said, for me, it's Sound of Music.
Oh. Whoa.
Hamilton.
What?
Mamma Mia.
Wow.
And Wicked. Now, okay, the fact that y'all reacted like kind of like, meh, to the last two, I would go the opposite way. I think Hamilton is sort of like basic people like Hamilton, right?
Okay.
Like, I mean,
okay.
That's sort of how I feel.
But then I feel like you could say that about a lot of Andrew Lloyd Webber, basic people like Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Sure. Oh, yeah. So which one? Cats? I don't know.
Most,
Starlight?
A lot of them.
Cats.
We're going to go through
it
all
may,
of them.
It may be
Joseph,
Phantom.
Anyway, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
Mamma Mia and Wicked, to me, are the ones where I'm like, those aren't basic. There's nothing basic about it. Mamma Mia's great. I love Mamma Mia. ABBA. Mm. ABBA.
Yeah, no.
ABBA?
Here's the thing with Mamma Mia. After seeing Mamma Mia, I'd rather just listen to ABBA albums. I don't need that dopey story. Like,
I mean,
that's my problem.
You could say Les Mis is basic. I feel like basic people like Les Mis, you know? But I also
but it's
love
not
Les Mis.
Oh, it is,
Les Mis very is basic people like Les Mis.
Oh, Jesus. Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds. Made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss, debate, and disseminate. Well, we don't disseminate anymore. But we discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. I was trying to do it without the script. I'm stupid. This week we return to form again. This is part two. Boo, 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 boo.
Bow, bow.
We're discussing the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their works. I say macro because we don't dig in deep. We don't go moment for moment. That's not really our point here. If you're taking a test, find a different podcast.
I think once we get to season 10, we can go back and do more.
Maybe, yeah. But right
granular.
Now, I would argue, like,
revisit.
You listen to this episode because you already know Phantom and you want to hear three people kind of just be like, yeah, here's like how I feel about it. Great. Right? But this is part two of three of our mini-series covering the works of Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's right. Mm-hmm. It's Fantcast of the Pod Prep.
Just get one of those MIDI, like,
video game. I bet it's out there.
Oh, sure.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. I'll find one and put it at the end of the episode. Take a
listen.
Love
it. Love it.
So, last week we covered Evita, mm-hmm. and I have a couple things.
It was a hot episode.
It was a hot ep. But I have to be honest about a couple things. One, I'm really mad we didn't bring up Aida when we were talking about Tim Rice.
You
love Aida. Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm so mad. The other thing is, I was pretty harsh on Evita.
We were.
And I've rethought, like, I used the word garbage when describing the music, and I shouldn't have. I was just being hyperbolic. I don't think it's garbage. I just think there's like 4 interesting themes and the rest is not as exciting to me. Yeah. That's what mm-hmm. I was trying to say.
That's right. Fair.
I just want to make sure I got that out there. Someone listened and texted me and they were like, you're an asshole about Evita.
Drulo did call me and said his feelings were hurt.
Drulo Webb called you?
Yeah, we text regularly.
You're like, hey, Drulo, stop being a conservative.
right?
This week we're covering Phantom of the Opera, and next week we'll be covering School of Rock. And this week is CJ's pick. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why'd you pick it, Siege?
Yes, because CJ, why did you pick this?
This was a massive musical for me in my like preteen and early teen years. My parents took me to see it when I was like 11 or 12 or 13. And I was thinking about it. This musical, if you want to take someone to see a musical that has all of God's money for production, This is a musical you go see. Like, I remember we drove around the Fabulous Fox in St. Louis. Like, we were in the back lot area. There was like fucking 7 semi-trailers with Phantom of the Opera on the side of it for all of their set and props and costumes. Like, you don't do this musical with cubes. You just don't.
Maybe
we should figure it out.
Well, if you had the voices, you could maybe pull something cool off.
Maybe. I would love to see a modern day like redo of this, especially. I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts of this, and I'm excited to discuss it.
Absolutely. Scott, what's your relationship with Poto?
So, it came out when I was coming up. So, and being the natural contrarian that I was, I was always like, meh. Of all these people are screaming about how brilliant it is, then I question whether or not it's brilliant. But I remember seeing the tour of it. I remember having a good time at the time, but it didn't last long. And we'll get into it.
Sure.
It's certainly not my cup of tea, but I'll argue that I don't think it's really anybody's cup of tea. You've just been fooled into thinking that it is.
Right.
Ooh. Yeah.
Interesting. I was introduced to it by the songs first when a voice teacher handed it to me and was like, let's sing some of these songs.
Oh, yeah. I sang these songs in voice lessons.
And I was like, I like this. And then I went and saw the movie.
Oof. I want to talk about the movie because I saw it for the first time.
And I was 14 and I cried and I loved it. Or I was like 16. Aww. I don't know how old I was. And I loved it. And I was like, this is like one of the great films. And then we'll talk about it. And then since then, I've never seen it on stage, but I still have a lot of love for it. And also, like,
we gotta change that, Bailey.
Yeah,
I gotta
see it on stage.
I don't know. We're gonna have to make it happen.
I've watched the Royal Albert Hall production, and I've watched some onstage things. But I'd love to see it live. It's great. We're gonna dig a little deeper into it. We're gonna talk about our feelings about it. But first, there's something I like to do on the second episode, and it's really fun.
We haven't played this stinger in a while.
We haven't done the stinger in a while, and I prepped like a mofo.
Did you? Right on.
Yes.
Right on.
So drop that beat.
Phrenology.
Now, I'm going to try to go as fast as I can because we have a podcast date field trip after this.
We do.
I'm really excited.
We're all
about
going
it.
To see Cocaine Bear, and then we're going to eat at the Toothsome Emporium at
Universal. I'm gonna eat five milkshakes for dinner.
Hollywood. Yeah. At the City Walk. We're really excited about it. But okay, so I'm gonna try and bust through these, but stop me if you have an opinion on any of these things and we can talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, if I can just preface very quickly, Bailey, and I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
But you made
me think a lot after last week about JC Superstar being the peak. Yeah. And I'm interested to
which I still agree with.
To talk through here and see what comes before and after, and because I think that I'm solidly with you on that. So let's do this. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk through it. We'll see how you feel at the end. So he begins with something we talked about a little bit last week in Scottpedia, The Likes of Us in 1965, which is his first team up with Tim Rice, right? Mm-hmm. And it has a book by Leslie Thomas, and it's not actually produced anywhere until 2005. So it doesn't really count, but they did write it back then. It was produced at the Sidmonton Festival, which is Weber's festival for sort of premiering new things to like an invited audience, and he does it every year. But this was the 40-year collab anniversary of he and Tim Rice. So they put it up. And it was narrated by Stephen Fry, and it starred Hannah Waddingham.
That's fun.
It starred Hannah Waddingham of Ted Lasso.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it's about, like, I forgot what it's about now, but it's basically about, like, a guy who takes care of orphans or some shit. I don't remember. It's something like that.
Like Fagin?
It's literally based on a true story. Thomas John Bernardo, a philanthropist who founded Homes for Destitute Children. So I was... curt and awful about that, and I apologize.
No.
then he does Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, 1968. This is something that I really adore.
I had a big community theater summer with Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It was the summer that I was going into my freshman year in high school. I auditioned for it was being directed by our big area director, Ken Bradbury, who always did, he wrote musicals that were biblical. And then they were like, naturally he has to direct this. And
I mean, the Bible lends itself to musical theater. Let's be clear.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Okay, straight up.
I might still be a Christian if Christianity was all just musical theater. But,
if you were just like singing JCS in the church, you'd be like, I'm there.
But
my mind is clearer now.
Oh my God, come on.
Yeah.
I auditioned for the children's choir and was so good, they put me in the adult cast.
Wow.
And my dance, yes. My dance partner ended up being my boyfriend 4 years later. And like,
he was an adult?
He was like,
I'm confused,
17 or 18. Okay. And like, we didn't date that summer. It was after I went to college that we
dated. Tell us more.
Mm-hmm. No, but it was just a big summer for me. And my parents lost their fucking minds because we had already gone to see it at Sangamon State. It got extended to 14 performances. My dad came to see 12 out of the 14 performances.
That's awesome.
Just a big
hashtag support.
Yeah. My dad loves Andrew Lloyd Webber. Anyway, go on.
I love it. I love it so much. It started at Edinburgh Fringe.
Mm-hmm. No shit.
It's also a lyric by Tim Rice.
Okay.
Which, I mean,
yeah,
those lyrics rule. I mean, it's good. It's very good. It has a country song.
It starred Donny Osmond, who's, you know, historically part of the 12 ancient tribes of Israel. So
he is. Donny, he's a little bit country.
And a little bit rock and roll. No, that's
Weber.
Marie.
Weber's a little bit
also
rock
a lot
and roll.
A bit Mormon. So
a lot of bit Mormon, but and a lot of bit host of Pyramid. Yeah. So I played Jacob in fourth grade.
Cute, I love it.
And it was a huge moment for me. We did it in this huge amphitheater. But I have a small story. Now I wanted to be the Pharaoh because I had watched this VHS tape, which I still own, the same one that I used to watch as a kid. I watched it on loop when I was a kid, okay? Mm. So I was like, I am the Pharaoh. There is no universe
taking that.
It's a great part. Everybody loves that part.
Oh, yeah, it's good, okay? I was working on my Elvis. I had it down. I was like, I'm going to destroy this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I get in there to the audition. I'm in fourth grade, okay? and it ends up being between me and my best friend at the time, Connor.
Aww.
And we sing back and forth, and we sing back and forth, and they did it over and over again. I remember in fourth grade being like, "What is happening? Why do we keep doing it?"
Callbacks and in fourth grade.
I realized they were basing it on how the other kids were reacting. The other kids were reacting a little better to him. Okay.
Aww.
Now I felt like mine was cleaner.
Probably,
but he was playing to the crowd more, okay?
Yeah.
When they announced in that moment, they just said, okay, you're playing Pharaoh and Bailey, you're playing Jacob. I jumped to the floor, face down, and pounded like a child. Boom, 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 and went, ah! And then stood up and went, okay, cool, sounds good. I was so upset. It was like the only time in my life where I've ever like let out like legitimate
what we've all been feeling when we see casting go up. Yes.
That one. And it was cathartic and beautiful, and I'll never forget it. So after that, 1970, Jesus Christ Superstar, lyrics by Tim Rice again. We've done an entire episode on this because we covered the movie, so go listen to that. But CJ, do you have anything you want to say? I know you really love this musical. I love it too.
I fucking love it. I think, in my personal opinion, especially with my new feelings on Evita, it's the only really, really good musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber at this point in time. And the movie is still in my top 10 of all favorite movies. So
yeah, you love that movie. Great movie.
Yeah.
Okay. 1975, Jeeves, which in 1996 gets changed to By Jeeves. Interesting. It's
about the famous search engine.
Correct. Ask Jeeves. No. So this was like a huge flop that then got like brought back and flopped again in 96, and then got brought to Broadway and sort of flopped again. Sounds bad.
Yeah.
But it's based on the P.G. Wodehouse character Bertie Wooster and his loyal valet Jeeves, which is, it's just like these novels, a series of novels that Wodehouse wrote.
Okay.
Sounds really super British. But the book and lyrics are by Alan Ayckbourn or Ayckbourn.
Yeah.
Oh, you know who I love his comedies.
Yes.
I have a bunch of his shit on my bookshelf.
Hell yeah. So the one that most people maybe know is Absurd Person Singular. That's like kind
also
of
also the Norman Chronicles are big ones.
Yes, the correct. And then the one that I really know is Revengers Comedies. I was in it in high school. It's a 6-hour play. You do it like Angels, where you do two different nights. But we got to perform it as 1 6-hour thing for the school one day instead of school, and it was like one of the best things I've ever done in my life. They made a movie out of it in the 90s called Sweet Revenge with Sam Neill and Helena
Bonham Carter. Yeah,
and it's kind of
bad.
And Steve Coogan played the part that I played. anyway, then 1976, the very next year, Evita drops. Lyrics by Tim Rice again. I was mean about Evita. I apologize about that. But we did a whole episode about it. Go fucking listen to it.
Yeah.
Then he does in 1979, a few years later, Tell Me on a Sunday, which was another Sidmonton submission from him.
Mm.
This is his first experience with lyricist Don Black. Now, Don Black comes up a few other times later, but he co-wrote some of the best Bond themes with John Barry.
Oh, that's fun. Oh,
he did, like, Diamonds Are Forever and Thunderball and Man with the Golden Gun.
So, all right.
Yeah.
The Man with the Golden Gun.
Correct. So he does the lyrics for this, but Tell Me on a Sunday is a one-woman, one-act song cycle. And it's about, like, an English girl who comes to America and looking for love. And she starts in New York and goes to Hollywood.
Somebody
and goes
did
to
it
York
at
again.
Fringe. A few
Shannon
years ago.
Did.
Was it Shannon? Yeah,
Brendan's,
that's right.
Brendan Hunt's wife did this at Fringe. Matt Valley choreographed it. I remember went and saw it at Fringe. Yeah.
Brendan Hunt of Ted Lasso fame.
Yes, his wife.
His wife.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
She did it at Fringe a couple years ago.
Very
and
cool.
Yeah, it was. It's a very fringy, it's appropriate for Fringe. Yeah. It's
absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very that. And it was written for Marty Webb, but Bernadette Peters did a run of it.
Oh, probably. God damn
oh,
it.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Then you have Cats, 1981. One of my first Broadway shows in first grade. Lyrics based on Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats by T.S. Eliot. Additional lyrics after Eliot by Richard Stilgo and Trevor Nunn. But do y'all like Cats? You fuck
I
with
mean,
cats?
I saw it. I think when I was a kid, because I've been a lifelong cat lady. So like when my parents introduced me to it, I was like, there's a musical about cats. Mm. And then I finally just watched the movie a couple weeks ago. And honestly, I think the show would be better if they would just say, this is a kid show. That's it. That's my take on it. Like,
I don't think a kid could sit through it.
I couldn't.
When I was in first grade.
Look,
and saw
they're
it.
Acting like cats. They're
like, oh man, I would have fucking loved it.
I was in first grade. I had already seen Sound of Music. Mm-hmm. We went and saw Cats. We were like, this is going to rule. Our uh-huh. choir teacher was like, you're going to love it. I was like, great. We get there. I remember, well, first of all, I remember in like the first song, the woman in front of me turned around and went, stop smacking your damn gum. And
oh,
I went,
oh,
shit. And then about halfway through, I sort of zoned out and started, because like one of the sexy cats came down and like did a lap dance on my dad. And I remember having weird feelings about it. Mm-hmm. So I like sort of zoned out about it for the rest of the show.
That would make me zone out too.
I just sort of zoned out about it. And then I remember really vividly waking up and there being a pirate ship on stage and me being like, wait, what? Like made of junk. And then I fell back asleep. And then woke back up and the show was over. But that might have been a dream. But I've like looked everywhere for it. I don't think it exists. At one point, I think somebody found something that and sent it to me that was like, no, there was this like version and they like changed it later. And I was like, no, but that would have been before I was there. Like it doesn't matter. So all that to say, interesting. Cats is, I don't love Cats, but I used to watch it every time it was on PBS for those fucking telethons. I was like, yeah, let's watch
it. We always did the Les Mis one. Yeah.
And in the movie, this filmed stage version,
yes,
they would like actually have Mr. Mistopheles like disappear. And so I'm like, whoa, editing. But it was really exciting. And then I saw the movie twice in theaters. I've told this on the pod before, but once because I had to see the edit with the buttholes, and then I had to also see the edit without the buttholes. I had to do both cuts. And the second time I went, there was people there actually like dressed like Rocky Horror style as cats, throwing
cat
shit
heads
at the screen and like yelling. And I was like, this is actually a better way to watch this.
Yes.
Then in 1982, he does Song and Dance, which is actually a combination of two things. So it's the thing I talked about earlier, Tell Me on a Sunday, which was mm-hmm. the one-woman show, mm-hmm. is the first act. And then the second act is a dance piece to the music, this musical piece he wrote called Variations, which he wrote for his brother Julian, who is a cellist. So it's like a cello piece, and it's based on a Paganini thing or something like that. But it's a Sinminton thing. Then Starlight Express. Starlight Express. This is lyrics by Richard Stilgo again. And then there were some revisions later by Don Black and David Yazbek, who I love. He wrote Full Monty musical. And then you have, I'll get there in a second. This is inspired by the Railway series books by the Reverend W. Awdry. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's also a Frankenstein's monster, of three different abandoned projects. So it started as an animated TV series based on Thomas the Tank Engine that Andrew Lloyd Webber was writing songs for.
Okay. Right?
And then he was like, maybe this is just like, I take a couple of these songs and make like a novelty, like pop single with like a couple things on it. And then at one point he was like, I'm going to make an animated film based on Cinderella, which we'll get to later because he uses some of those songs later for something. But he starts working on that. And then he's like, what if I put this all together and just make a brand new musical about railway cars?
So and it's on roller skates, right?
Everyone's on roller skates. You want to know what the plot is?
Tell me.
There is none.
Oh, there's a plot.
It's a trick question.
There's a plot here. No, of course there is.
It's like Cats. There is none.
No, it's not like Cats at all. There is absolutely a plot here. It's about an obsolete steam engine, okay, who decides to compete in a race against modern engines in the hopes of impressing one of the first-class observation train cars. It makes perfect sense.
So it's his death of a salesman, basically, is what you're saying.
It's his death of a salesman. It's his Hamlet. It really, like, it sounds great. It's the ninth longest running West End show of all time. And it is the the most successful musical in Germany of all time.
They love David Hasselhoff over there. That doesn't surprise me.
It has been performed in a purpose-built theater.
I love it.
Since 1988. That means the theater is built for Starlight Express.
Roller skate musicals. We need to write more roller skate musicals.
That's absolutely
for
true.
Germany, but it for holds, the Germans.
For the Germans. It holds the Guinness World Record for most visitors to a musical in a single theater.
I love that. Oh, wow.
That
good.
Is crazy to me.
That's great, though.
Friend of the pod, Padraic Duffy, did get to see the original production in London as a kid.
That's radical.
And he said it was crazy because there's a ramp that goes out from the stage and goes around the audience. He's like, so you have people roller skating next to your head.
Yeah.
He's like
roller derby.
He's like, you were just waiting for a crash. It. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. You ever seen the movie Rollerball?
Oh, yeah.
No.
The original Rollerball or the remake?
The original, James
Caan. The original. Yeah, Rollerball's crazy cool.
You ever seen Solar Babies?
Solar Babies? Absolutely, I've seen
that
Solar
movie
Babies.
Fucking slaps.
That's so good.
It's like Mad Max Thunderdome without Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly.
And they just play Rollerball. And they, should we talk about Solar Babies for a half hour?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Is that the episode?
I need to see it, but I want to hear all about it.
I think we have our next in stuff.
You got to check it out. I don't know Starlight Express at all. I've never seen it. But I
just know all the jokes made about it. That's it.
Right, of course.
A medley of it in college in show choir. We had to do our Starlight Express medley. So I remember the songs from it. Yeah,
that sounds fun.
It was fun.
I was told a story about a version of Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime that was all on roller skates. And I was like, that sounds kind of rad. I would have loved to see that.
Yeah, right.
Okay, then in 1986, he does a musical commissioned and performed for Queen Elizabeth's 60th birthday.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember hearing about this. Okay.
So it's about a cricket club. It's called Cricket.
Sounds very British.
Yes, and this is he and Tim Rice's final collaboration.
Oh.
Yeah, they never worked together again. There is something that comes up later where Tim Rice had written songs previous that he ends up using for something later, so you could count that, but let's not. Then he does in 1986, the same year, The Phantom of the Opera, something
busy
we'll never
year.
Talk about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then in 1989, he does Aspects of Love, working with Don Black again, and now with Charles Hart, who he'll work with a few more times. And this is based on the David Garnett novel of the same name. It ran on Broadway in 1990, but mostly now it's only produced in England. Like, I've never seen it. I know a few people who have talked about, like, auditioning for it at community theaters and things. Well, I don't know much about it. It follows a bunch of love entanglements over 17 years.
I had a girlfriend who was obsessed with it, so I remember listening to the CD in her car.
You've gotten a lot of music uploads from girlfriends, Scott.
I think it was the same one. It was definitely the same one around the
I also knew a lot of like theater kids, especially in high school and college, who just like they heard Weber and they're like, great, I love that, give it to me. And they would listen to it no matter what, and then they would love it because they were listening to it, but like doesn't necessarily mean it's good,
right?
But it could be great.
Sure.
I don't know.
Sure.
This is the problem with the Jesus Christ Superstar is where he peaked. I don't know every single one of these things.
Yeah,
but the
either.
Fact that they're not produced very much makes me think, okay, well, they can't be that great, but maybe they are. Then in 1993, he does Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
a bunch
a big
of Tonys.
One.
It does the whole thing. Yeah, this is Christopher Hampton and Don Black again, based on the Billy Wilder film, you know, of the same, I think it was 50, 55, something like that. Centered around the aging film star Norma Desmond. Everyone knows the story. Go watch Sunset fucking Boulevard. But originated by Patti LuPone. And then it became Glenn Close.
Mm-hmm.
I think Glenn Close got the revival Tony for it. I could be wrong.
I think you might be right about that.
A bunch of really cool people have done West End runs of it. Rita Moreno did a West End run of it. That's kind of cool.
All right.
It's currently running, I believe, right now. If not, if it hasn't closed already or if it's about to open. But it's like, I think it's right now at the Kennedy Center with Stephanie J. Block and Derek Klina.
Kind of
cool. Whose brother I have worked with. Then in 1996, So a few years have passed, 3 more years. Whistle Down the Wind. Have y'all heard of this one?
I've heard of it. I know nothing about it.
Yeah, as an anecdote, like it wasn't, it kind of flopped, right?
It did. It's so interesting. It's lyrics by Jim Steinman and a book by Patricia Knopp.
Yeah, correct.
And it's based on the 1961 film Whistle Down the Wind, whose source novel of the same name was written by Mary Haley Bell in 1958 and blah, 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 blah. It takes place in the small town of Louisiana, and it's produced a lot in England.
Okay. Mm.
I've never seen it.
My voice teacher always wanted to throw music at me from it, but that's all I know of it.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I don't know any of that. I've never heard it.
Yeah.
I just knew that it kind of existed and was kind of this bust after Sunset Boulevard was kind of how it was always framed to me.
Yeah. Then in 2000, The Beautiful Game, another one I don't know very well. I've heard some songs from, but it's book and lyrics by Ben Elton, who wrote We Will Rock You, the musical, a Bad Queen jukebox. and then he also ends up writing Love Never Dies with him later, which we'll talk a lot about later. And then The Beautiful Game was updated later in 2009 to be called The Boys in the Photograph. It's about a group of teenagers growing up during the Troubles, quote unquote, in Belfast, Northern Ireland in 1969. Mm. Huh. 2004, The Woman in White, lyrics by David Zappel, book by Charlotte Jones based on the Wilkie Collins novel. Right.
This was huge the summer I was in London, because I was in London in 2005.
Yeah,
it was all over the place. I didn't see it, though.
It's also, the novel is, the elements of it are based on the short story The Signal Man by Charles Dickens, which is kind of interesting. It ran for 19 months on the West End and only 3 months on Broadway, which makes it one of his, like, shortest running shows of all time. Then in 2010, he does a pseudo-sequel to Phantom of the Opera called Love Never Dies. Mm-hmm. Book and lyrics by Glenn Slater, book by Ben Elton and Frederick Forsyth, and additional lyrics by Charles Hart. So Weber stated, I don't regard this as a sequel. It's a standalone piece. He later clarified, clearly it is a sequel, but I really do not believe that you have to have seen Phantom of the Opera to understand Love Never Dies. He subsequently explained, he didn't view it as a sequel as much as a second story with the same characters.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the musical... I listened to that cast recording one time.
I sat down
and listened to it top to bottom, and I was like, cool, I can move on with my life.
I
feel like I've done that.
It's set in 1907, which they state in it that it's 10 years after the end of Phantom of the Opera, but year-wise, it's not.
Mm. Yeah.
Phantom of the Opera is in 1881, so it's like kind of this weird, like, well, it's 8 years, okay, or, you know, whatever, 9 years, you know, but it doesn't matter. It takes place on Coney Island.
So stupid.
And we're going to talk a lot about it later because I don't want to get to what it's about until we talk about the plot of Phantom of the Opera.
Sure.
But then in 2011, he does The Wizard of Oz, which is based fully on the movie, the 1939 movie. So this is him putting out his own, like, what if the movie on stage and not just, like, the musical that everyone... So, like, it's new music, though.
Yeah.
So it's not...
No, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Yeah.
Correct. It's so weird. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I've known a few people who have seen it on the West End and been like, no, it's good, it's charming. And I'm like, yeah, but do we need it? This is one of those where this was... There are songs in here where Tim Rice wrote the lyrics, but they were written for something else a long time ago.
Okay.
That kind of thing. Yeah,
and not to digress for just that you brought it up. Do we know what happened? Why their relationship dissolved? Did they just
I don't know.
Kind of went on. I've never read about it. I've never read that. You know, I heard that there's bad blood, but I
oh
but
yeah maybe
but I don't
it, it
but
might
I don't
have
know.
Just been the Disney of it all, like Rice just being like, okay, I'm gonna go write with Elton John now.
Yeah, and Alan Menken and
write Aida and exactly. So I don't know. In 2013, he writes a musical called Stephen Ward with his new collaborators Christopher Hampton and Don Black. It's based on the 1963 Profumo affair, which is like a British political scandal I know zero about. Sounds bad. School of Rock 2015.
Talk about
that next week. And then in 2021, he released a musical on the West End called Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cinderella. That is something that he has wanted to do for a very long time. Since he wrote Starlight Express. He was writing music for it, blah, blah, blah. Okay, another thing we don't really need, but
it's another thing we don't really need.
It's currently about to run on Broadway.
Oh,
but it's being billed. It's going to be called Bad Cinderella.
Okay.
Now, I think it's meaning to be like bad Cinderella, like badass Cinderella.
I'm bad.
I'm bad. You're bad. It's a saggy title because it sounds like this is Cinderella, but bad. Bad Cinderella. Bad Cinderella.
Yes.
So kind of interesting, but it changes some things. Like there's some recast gender relationships and it's about beauty shaming sort of. And Cinderella changes her appearance to secure
her love. She takes her glasses off and then she's hot at the prom.
Yeah, she does that. But then I guess the final moment is her being like, actually, I'd rather wear my glasses. And you're like, great.
You go, girl. Bad Cinderella. You're bad.
Bad Cinderella. You're bad. Sounds like a bad 90s movie that didn't happen that he's just held on to for a really long time. But that's okay. All that to say, now we're in 2023. Who knows what's coming next? I have no idea. I don't really want to know. But, Scott, back to you. Did he peak? Do you know Sunset Boulevard? That's the only one I think you could contest. But I don't love it as much as I love JCS.
Yeah, I agree. I do think it was kind of I remember when it came out, it was kind of being talked about as a comeback of sorts for him. It's one of those ones. You know, it's this funny thing about source material and all that. I would rather watch Sunset Boulevard the movie than see or listen to the musical. The musical's cool, it's kind of fun, and he does some interesting stuff, but I don't need it, but it wasn't bad either. It wasn't.
It's also the whole remake thing, you know? It's not it was already a movie. It's not like it's an original story or I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the thing about when you look at when you take the macro look at his stuff, there aren't a lot of great ideas in here. You know what I mean? Like, and the ones that should be interesting aren't.
Yeah.
I.e. Phantom. We'll get to it in a second. And so going back to JC's Superstar, that was the great idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to tell this musical and we're going to tell it from Judas's point of view. A, at that time, how controversial just that idea was, but then to pull it off and to pull it off with big balls and great fucking songs.
I don't think
he ever does that again.
Question, because I know y'all will know. Where did Jesus Christ Superstar fall in relation to The Temptation of Jesus Christ? Because I know that was another thing people talked about.
The Last Temptation.
It
was about 10, 15 years, I think.
It came out before.
Way before.
Way before Last Temptation.
Cool. Yeah, so it was edgy as fuck. Yeah.
Beetlejuice is the most basic musical. okay, so...
Meow!
Yeah,
<exactly.
laughs> Okay, let's talk about Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Let's do it.
I don't know what it's about.
I don't either.
I know...
I don't think... I don't know if Andrew Lloyd Webber does either. Boom!
Boo. Siege.
Yeah.
Tell me.
CJ's Breakdown. What the internet says. The story of a beautiful soprano, Christine Daae, who becomes the obsession of a mysterious, masked musical genius living in the subterranean labyrinth beneath the Paris Opera House. What I think, A long abused and violently psychotic maniac terrorizes the Paris Opera House while taking advantage of, kidnapping, and brainwashing a young woman who lost her father at a young age. While being kidnapped, he gives her singing lessons and then threatens and or hurts any producer, manager, or patron who will not give her the lead in the currently running opera. And hold on to your hats when she decides she likes a guy.
Here's my take. CJ's take is correct, and other people morph it into the first thing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I don't think this is romantic in terms of her and the Phantom, and I will get to why, and I think other people make it that way. I don't think that's his point here, because she sees him as... We'll talk about it later.
Well, and I my perspective, especially when I came to this musical and why I loved it so much, I don't know that I thought it was some big romantic story between the Phantom and Christine, but I came to it as a preteen slash teenager when the only love I had was obsessive, weird love, like a 12 or 13 year old has.
Yeah, sure.
And so I really got into that. It's like, Bailey, you introduced me to the Lolita podcast, and she talks about reading Lolita as a teenager and thinking it was this big, it was kind of a love story, because mm-hmm. that's the kind of love you feel when you're that age.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like, I had this really close friend who I won't call out their name, but I had this really close friend in high school who was like obsessed with Phantom, and we would sing it and we would do all these things, but she had a Phantom tattoo, like all these things. And it was like, you know, the mask and the rose or whatever. But I remember her saying to me one day, like, one day I will find my Phantom. And I went,
oh no.
Wait, you mean your Raul? And she was like, no, my Phantom. And that, it like broke my brain, because I had never seen the musical that way. I had always been like, that's not what this is about. What are you, Gerard Butler's the bad guy.
Have you spoken to her? How does she feel about the musical now? Do you have any idea?
I haven't talked to her about it in years, okay. But I'd be interested to know. Honestly, I assume she's just as enamored.
Well,
we can get off of it. That's a weird subject.
I also had a friend of mine, a straight guy friend, who was obsessed with Phantom. Mm. And about being the Phantom. Mm-hmm. And at the time...
That's gross.
And what occurred to me later... Well, this is... we were teenagers, you know, when it came out. And
gross
so
teenagers.
Huge. I wasn't.
We were all gross when we were teenagers.
I always kept it at arm's length. I was like... Because I had seen, by that point, I had seen both of the movies, the Lon Chaney and the Claude Rains.
There's like 9.
Well,
there are quite a few.
The two big ones. But, and it was all, I always had it in my head as a horror story, that it was a horror movie. And so even when you read about him looking for a romantic thing, a romantic story to tell, and then he finds, you know, a copy of the book in New York, and it's been out of rotation and publication. And I'm like, what are you seeing, brah? Like, yeah, what is where's the
romantic
romance
and
here?
Gothic hold hands, right? And I think that's really what he means. He doesn't even mean like the
no, he's
there is romance here. The Raoul story is romantic, and the grandioseness of opera is romantic, right? Well, that's sort of
and
romance.
Something brand new I learned about this this time around. I was such a mega fan of this that after I saw this musical, I bought all the books on it, but I read the novel by Gaston Leroux twice, which I couldn't even tell you it's been 20 years at least since I've read it.
Yeah.
And then I've seen the Lon Chaney film, and I remember being, you know, I was a teenager when I saw it, being very creeped out by it. I mean, the whole idea of silent film, especially horror films, are very creepy to me.
Oh, yeah.
But something I learned this time around that I didn't know, Gaston Leroux wrote this for a Paris newspaper a la Sherlock Holmes. It was an episodic that people were like opening up the newspaper to read about every week. Yeah. And I didn't know that about this story.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
And yeah, I think that what occurred to me as I got into college and out of college when this would come back up is that people weren't really breaking this down or analyzing it in a way that struck me. And I hate to use the word superficial, but it's, and my big take is that this is a superficial spectacle you know, it's a Disney ride. You know,
yes.
CJ said you couldn't do this with cubes. No, because it'd be utterly uninteresting. Like the chandelier.
I think there's a world
the
where
boat.
You could make it interesting.
I wrote down a list of maybe. All the major visual moments of this. Yeah. Of this play that are, it's all tech. It's well, so, all big props. It's
yeah,
all,
so let's yeah. talk about just, because you've brought up the Lon Chaney movie. The Phantom of the Theater concept in general is something I love.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Like that story, the Lon Chaney movie, obviously, Universal.
Who doesn't blame all the bullshit in their theater on the ghost that haunts it? Everybody right. does that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. I have a whole TikTok about it. Holy shit. But then you have, you know, Phantom of the Paradise is one that is kind of a cult classic. Phantom yes. of the Megaplex. Anyone know that one?
Yeah. No, I've seen it on shelves.
Made for
stuff.
TV Disney. Disney Channel original movie that was pretty good. And then you have the Phantom of the Opera, but it's just Freddy Krueger. Have you seen that yeah. one?
Oh, that's
yeah.
fun.
It's yeah. not. It's Robert Englund, but it's like amidst him making the sequels of the Freddy movies. So it's like, you're kind of like, all it's right. basically a Freddy movie.
Yeah.
And then one of my favorites of all time, which I rewatched last night because I was just kind of hyped on listening to Phantom and I was like, oh, I want to rewatch this. Opera by Dario Argento.
Oh.
Dario Argento made this film called Opera where they're doing Verdi's Macbeth. I'm producing that right now so I can say it.
Uh-huh.
And it's, but the star of it, who's playing Lady M, gets kidnapped by the opera ghost and he puts needles under her eye so that she has to watch all of the other cast be murdered.
Like, oh my hardcore God.
It's hardcore. Yeah, but like, worse.
Hardcore,
like,
right? Okay.
It's so bloody. It's very Gaio film, like that. Kind
yeah,
of
yeah, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure we got that said because those yeah. that concept in general is so prevalent, and like that book obviously starts the idea, but the opera ghost, the theater ghost, has been a thing.
For
since,
yeah,
I
sure.
think it was pretty much since lore in the Paris Opera House too, and I think the
for
thing
sure.
that. Really got me into it too was knowing that the Paris Opera House was an actual place and there was an actual fucking lake underneath it, and like
yeah
that's cool.
the chandelier did fall one time and killed somebody, but it
crazy.
Was just, you know, bad wiring and bad attachments.
Was
it? I was kind of curious, and maybe I don't know, this is maybe 2023, CJ thinking too hard. I was wondering if this was almost a blank check for Andrew Lloyd Webber, because
sure.
surely there had to be people in the theater community that was like, come on, man.
This is his post Evita blank check.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, right? Mm-hmm. It's like Evita gets him the ability to do this, and this is him being like, cool, sweeping, epic, giant, mm-hmm. something
yes.
in an opera house. I'm going to write opera. Well, I'm going to attempt opera. I'm yeah. going to, you know, like, there's some things, but for the most part, it's like pretty basic opera. But the setting is really interesting. Opera populaire, mm-hmm. you know, Paris.
A very grand time in Paris. Yeah.
It starts out in that auction house
yeah.
and very dark and dim and morose and old Raoul sits there. And
yes.
Vicomte de Chagny.
And what's so amazing about that is that it shows you that Raoul never became interesting for all of those years.
Raoul's boring.
It's the worst. It's just like, ugh, I just want to punch him and drown him in the river.
I would Aww. Argue no character in
Stop
this
it.
Is well built.
No.
Like,
no.
None.
Yeah.
No.
Like, maybe Carlotta.
She's fun.
She's awesome. Like, we know more about Carlotta than we do Christine, right?
Yeah.
Like, we get way more backstory.
Yeah.
Which, again, reading the novel is interesting because you get a shit ton of backstory about her dad and the relationship they had and
sure.
where she came from, and that's fun.
Right. And then you have the song in Act Two, which we'll get to, but mm-hmm. where she actually sings about him for the first time. And this is kind of where... Well, actually, I'll save this, but I really do believe there's something about it being fatherly rather than romantic for her. She thinks
yes.
it's her father the whole time.
Yeah.
Which is why
or,
when
or
things,
that he
certain
was sent
things happen,
from
it's even
her
more
father.
Fucked up.
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah, we'll get there. I think she
yes.
thinks it's literally her father. I like, we'll get there. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
We'll get there. Let's step through it. Why don't we do that? We never really do that with things. I don't want to get minute, but let's step through it because it is big, and I want to hear like what when you get lost, like when you stop, when you start being like, that doesn't work for me. That doesn't, because I'm not defending this. However, because I see all the problems, I really do. However, I can't help but get swept up a little bit when I watch
it. I still get swept up.
Much like a Disney ride. How I'm on Little Mermaid. Bad ride, to be clear. I cry every time.
Ariel's Grotto.
Yeah. I cry every time. But it's like, it's that. There's something to it. And maybe it's nostalgia. Maybe it's the sort of Weber, Pascal Paul kind of, I'm writing extremely
emotionally
manipulative music for you. And maybe I'm giving into that a little bit. But I do think it's like today, bad. Then, very earnest and very interesting. Sure. And I wonder if like our lack of wanting earnest makes us hate this more than we should, though I do understand it's bad. I'm with you. My hands are up.
You. I mean, and you know, the nostalgia, like I remember the night going to see the tour of it and the spectacle.
Did you see anyone exciting in it?
I can't remember. I was trying to rack my brain about it. It was like the second national tour, I think. But I don't recall. I do remember, you know, having a good time. Although, like now, things that popped up this time around and just rewatching the movie, like it's very disparaging to theater people. It shows very like, look at the diva, look at the asshole, look at the depravity of it.
I mean, who doesn't like giggling about an Italian soprano from the turn of the century? I mean,
the dirtiness and the depravity side of it, though, Scott. The depravity side I actually do like. I like that it's sort of like, yeah, and the people up in the bowels of the theater are kind of dirty.
Joseph Bouquet. I have to say, actually, because I do want to talk about the 2004 movie because I just saw it for the first time. Something, the only thing, in my opinion, that movie got right and something that I do kind of appreciate about the musical, even if it does poke fun a little bit, is the whole theater people thing. Behind the scenes, being backstage, the chorus girls, you know, trying to scramble on stage when they've called something that you're not ready for. Like, that's kind of endearing, I guess, a little bit.
The movie is better than the stage show. Okay, we'll get to that later. It's fine. It's just a hot take that is sizzling, burning hot. It's scalding.
That will make both of you cringe.
No, it's scalding. Okay, so Carlotta. The first thing we get is Mini the Carter. Hannibal opera, right? We get this huge, after auction. So we get the auction, and then they reveal the chandelier which is
up.
Radical in terms of theater, like, epicness, right? We get this reveal, and it's... Dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun, it goes on forever.
It's Pink Floyd.
It's Pink Floyd. Echoes starts playing. Dun, 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 dun. And we talked about this last time, but Pink Floyd actually, they never took action on it, but the bassist was sort of like... That's my bass line that I wrote for the song Echoes. You're using it. You can't. One half step different. That's rough.
Well, and then
also,
the way
it's
that
just
it...
a chronological thing. You know what I'm saying. It's not like crazy musical innovation.
Right.
It's just a chromatic kind of.
That's what
I mean. Yeah. But it's. I don't think it is truly chromatic. But it is sort of just that like. It could have been written by 500 different people over the years and
but
only
they
got
came
famous
up with
parts.
It.
But it's also like, how it shows up in that Pink Floyd song. Like it comes in and it's like boom. Like it kind of grabs you after 4 minutes of lead up to it. And you're like, so it makes sense that you would rip it off because that's going to jar everybody into your shit. Yeah.
Well, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, Joseph and Jesus Christ Superstar are very like rock influenced. And there is a twinge of that in here, and the movie actually like triples on it. It's like,
he's got like, some whoa. Guitar players. Like, you could tell they just brought the guy in. Hey, bro, can you riff on this? I got you.
There's no Pink Floyd.
There's a part in the movie where a drum sound machine kicks in and goes, and you're like, okay, relax. But it's pretty funny. But so we get the auction, the boom of the cathedral. I mean, cathedral, the chandelier, which I'm sure is on stage is epic. And
it is. We got to take you, Bailey. I'm going to find a live performance of this, and I'm going to buy a fucking ticket. It's going to be fun.
We'll do it. But then you get the Hannibal opera stuff, which is all big and grandiose and fun and seems like a lot of set for not a lot of story.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm just really like, whoa.
You got it, bro.
Which in the movie, they match. With they match set for set and person for person and movement for movement in that opening scene.
Yeah, they did a good job with that. That's that's a solid part of the movie. And then you get some of the ballet. They sort of point out who Christine is. And then the first time we get like some notice that there's a phantom or whatever, you get Meg, who needs to fucking chill, screaming, "He's here, the Phantom of the Opera!" And it's the first time we hear that sort of
well,
riff.
And in the stage, Meg, in the stage chill, version, what I well, they did it in the movie. Yeah, a backdrop just drops all of a sudden and almost hits Carlotta.
Carlotta, yes. Yeah. You got Madame Jury, good character. Kind of a bad character. She's
a bigger deal in the book.
Yeah. I feel like she could get a better arc than just being the person who tells the story.
She's the creepy old lady that tells the ghost stories the whole time.
Yeah.
And then you get the guys who are buying the opera, and they're kind of fun.
They're my favorite characters, to be honest.
They're interesting.
Yeah. They've got the best stuff, I think. They're funny. They give you a breath whenever things are getting weird or creepy. They always have the joke at the end. And I love that.
And they're the best casting of the movie.
Correct.
Without question.
Fucking Simon Callow and Kieran, what's his name?
Yes. Hines. Yes. From Hines. Yeah, Hines. Yeah, they're genius in the movie. And that whole side of it, the comedy side of it in the movie, again, we'll get to the movie, but like Minnie Driver and all that, like very, very well done. Then you get Think of Me, which is her taking over for Carlotta, a song that lives in my mind rent-free. I know
Sang
every second
voice
of
lessons.
That song.
Yeah.
I just know every second of the song. I know the movie version. I know the stage version. It just lives there. But then we get this huge chunk that's pretty much all sung, and it goes from Angel of Music with Meg and Christine all the way through Music of the Night.
Yeah.
And it starts with Angel of Music, which I think this whole thing slaps and is sort of the crux of what this whole musical is. So you get Angel of Music into the big Phantom of the Opera song, which is 2 minutes too long.
There's a shit ton of magic tricks from Angel of Music through Music of the Night too, which makes it a little bit better live.
You get the boat, you get the big mirror.
You get the mirror, all of a sudden there's a lake on stage.
Yeah, you're like, what the fuck? Apparently the boat doesn't work a lot of the time.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then you get to Music of the Night, and I think what's happening through that, correct me if I'm wrong, is the insinuation that he molests her during this time period.
Yeah, I read that.
That he sort of drugs and, or at least sort of like hypnotizes her and assaults her, and then sings this Music of the Night song to her, and she's like, okay, I guess that sure.
And then he shows her the wedding dress. He's let's get married.
Right.
And I mean, that's the crux of the problem, is that he's a groomer, he's a pedophile, and starts grooming her when she's a child.
But like you said, this is a horror film. Not a horror film, but it's a horror story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I argue this is scary. Like, I'm like, fuck, this is not good.
But the music is so great.
It's irresponsibly consumed by people, I think, which all
right.
Are.
That's a good well way to put, think of it. Really well put.
But, and again, maybe Weber is not trying to do what I'm picking up on. I might be giving him way too much credit. But it feels to me like she's like, this is my father, or something my father wants from me.
Yeah.
He uses that to manipulate her and make her and hypnotize her and do whatever and make her his sex slave and bride.
Mm-hmm. But also gives her singing lessons.
Right. She gives into it weekly and becomes this huge opera star that's being abused. But then she meets this childhood friend who's trying to bring her back to innocence. Like, no, wait, come back to, what are you talking about? There's no opera ghost. There's nothing happening to you. Let me gaslight you into believing that there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
And then she finally decides, like, no, I'm not going to keep being abused. I'm going to move on. And that's when everything explodes, right? So Love Never Dies, though, Scott, would make you die. You would kill yourself if you watched it. It's so bad. Okay, we'll get to it. Oh, the audience doesn't get to clap through all those songs, so there's always like a huge break after Music of the Night, but he holds that final note. Like way too low, you know.
With the chord, slow chord progression underneath. It's
dissonant and weird and cool. And then we get that gas release of Prima Donna. Prima Donna.
Which I love that
stuff is fun.
Song.
That's a fun song.
Yeah.
You get a lot of the silliness. This is some of the more fun theater stuff. Carlotta gets to do some fun shit. You got to really have some pipes to be Carlotta.
I mean, this is, we talk about it with Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, this is a show that you have people in this that need to be classically trained. There is actual
operatically trained.
Sure. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Like, I would argue, I watched the Royal Albert Hall version and it's Sarah Brightman. Mm-hmm. And she's not Sarah Brightman. Sarah Brightman's the original.
She's the original.
What is her name? It's Sarah something another. It's Sierra Bodges. Okay, so who is fine, but you can feel her being a little less operatically trained than the people singing opera,
mm-hmm.
right? Anyway, opera. And then you get the dude hanging. Dude gets hung.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been telling tales on the Phantom.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you get All I Ask of You, where she finally makes the decision. And one of the more earnest and sort of, I assume, like laughter-inducing parts of the movie for a lot of people is, you'll curse the day you did not do all that the Phantom asked of you. And it's Gerard Butler with his hands up in the air, like fucking Willem Dafoe at the end of Platoon. Chandelier falls, end of act one, and then you get Masquerade, which is like one of the great musical theater stage numbers.
Love it so fucking much. And it's another big stage magic trick. Like, everyone's dancing, it's all these beautiful insane costumes on this huge staircase, and then all of a sudden, I mean, the movie, in my opinion, doesn't do his costume justice. When it's in the live stage version, it's this big, crazy, the Red Death costume.
Yeah.
And the skull moves with his mouth, like, and he just appears. And then there's a moment where he comes
in
down
the
steps.
They just make it like,
and there's
a
puff of smoke, and then another Red Death appears at the top of the step. Like, it's a big, magic, tricky, huge cast number. Like, it's great. It's a good act two opener.
And choreography-wise, it's supposed to be kind of like, meh, masquerade. You don't like masquerades? You don't like masks? You don't like
it's
good
just,
choreography?
I'm not like, saying it's great theater. It was great theater when I was 13. That's all.
It's also the song that plays on the little music
the little
box.
The monkey box.
Yeah.
Which, okay, it doesn't matter. I was going to go into this whole thing when I was 14 that like broke my brain because I was like, wait, did he write Masquerade? Did he write the song that he's... So the Phantom says they have to do his opera.
Don Juan,
triumphant. Then you get the story of the Phantom from Madame Jury. He's a genius. He's rich. He's a magician. We're like, oh, okay, got it.
Which, I'm sorry, when they get to actually performing Don Juan, who wants to do that fucking opera? Like, the songs aren't, they're just weird and dissonant and hard to listen to.
But that's the whole joke, right? Or that's the whole bit, is that they all keep saying, this is bad. Why are we learning? There's a whole scene that gets cut out of the movie, actually. There's a whole scene where the big opera star, the man, is trying to learn it and can't.
Right.
Because it keeps being like, this, it doesn't make sense musically.
Right.
And they're like, you just have to do it or we're all going to die.
So he kills him later. It's fine.
And he kills him later. But that's sort of the bit, is that it's like, it's almost bad.
Yeah.
And he's a genius, and so he's doing all this crazy stuff, but it's like, I think Weber's take is like, it's like beyond their time. Like, they can't even comprehend it. It's so genius.
Which,
and I'm like,
Don
no,
Juan
it just sounds
is a
bad.
Tale as old as time type of story, isn't it? It's just about a dude that fucks a lot of chicks. from like the 1700s or something.
To me, it's sort of just like, it's about debauchery. It's about evil. It's about the devil's man. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just like, okay. She goes, sings Wishing You Were Somehow Here Again, a big song for a lot of people. I know that's like a big like audition
it's
song.
It's a sweet
for a
song.
Lot of,
yeah.
It's cute. And then the Phantom officially kidnaps her during the show.
Again.
Again. Raoul comes and saves her like the bland canvas knight, white knight that he is. Boring mofo. And then she has to choose between them. Keep the hand at the level of your eyeball of your eye. and then, you know, she basically, he's like, go with Raoul. I've been an asshole. I'm really sorry. This is the part where
sorry.
I start to agree with you, Scott, where I'm like, I don't like this moment where he kind of gets to be like, you're right. I just really love you. I know I'm so ugly. You'll never be with me. I'll move on. Not like, you're right. I assaulted you. I did horrible yes. things. It's yeah. just like, I'm too ugly. I get it. Move on. And then he like famously like disappears on stage. And that's like a big magic trick.
Another huge magic trick at the end of the motherfucking show.
Yeah, pretty cool.
You forget about what's going on because you're like, oh, where'd he go? It's just because I've never done any research on it, but I still don't quite know how they make that whole thing work. But it's also been me
There's
sitting
no
30
back
rows back
to the chair. Is what I believe after watching the Royal Albert Hall production.
Oh.
I believe it's a giant chair he sits in. He covers himself with a thing, and then there's something over his head that keeps that shape.
Uh-huh.
And then he slips out, he ducks out through the back of the throne chair.
All right.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was watching really carefully and watched it like 9 times. I was like trying to figure out. Like, this is. I think this is what it is. But end of show. Audience goes wild.
Mm-hmm.
Scott spits on the stage.
Yep. Scott quits theater.
Scott quits the podcast and leaves. But yeah, so we can get into it a little deeper, but I did want to talk about Love Never Dies for a second.
Do it. I don't know anything about it other than it's...
I really only stepped through the entirety of the show so we could get here.
Yes.
So... Love Never Dies. 10 years later, 9 years later, who fucking cares? It's 10 years later, and Christine and Raoul have a son. And she gets a letter from Oscar Hammerstein that says, hey, I want you to come to America, the first, Oscar Hammerstein the first. I want you to come to America and do a musical for me at Coney Island. And she goes, great. And she right shows away. Up. But who was it really that sent the message? It was the Phantom.
The Phantom
he's
of Coney
still
Island.
Alive. And he's residing in Coney Island because apparently that's where he was when he was like a circus freak, quote unquote.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Long... boring, badly written story short. It ends up on like this bridge, and Christine and Raoul's kid is there. I don't remember what happens to Raoul. He's dead or he's gone. Or no, he's not dead because he has to show up at the auction house. Yeah, but he's somewhere else. But the child is there, and Christine and the child are like. On one side of the bridge, and there's this woman who has been performing at Coney Island who's like in love with the Phantom. She's kind of a quote unquote freak of the carnival.
Okay.
And she's like, you're so obsessed with Christine. I hate you. I hate it. And she has this gun and she's like trying to kill the little boy at one point. And they finally get the little boy back. And then she like throws the gun and it ends up shooting Christine.
She throws the gun at
it. Spoiler alert!
Shoots.
Sorry. Yeah. So Christine gets shot.
That's how she dies. That's why Raoul's at the
Correct.
Auction alone. Okay.
So Christine is dying, and as she dies, the Phantom comes to her side.
This
and
is the backstory I needed.
Yeah. And Christine is being held by the Phantom, and the little boy is there going, "Mom, Mom," and throughout the musical, they have gotten closer. He's finally convinced her, like, "I'm not crazy. I'm, you know, I really do love you." And she's like, "I really did love you too." Which is what destroys everything good about the first story, in my opinion. So she's like, I really did love you. I've always loved you. I've never wanted to be with Raoul. And you're like, wait, what?
Which
to me, maybe it's about like, you know, a little bit of that syndrome.
It's a two-part story
cycle
about
abuse.
Cycle
of abuse.
It's Stockholm syndrome. Mitch got Stockholm syndrome.
But like, then the big reveal is that in that night of potential assault, or maybe she consented to having sex with the Phantom in that night.
Listen, the bed curtains are drawn. Maybe she consented.
Right. During the Phantom of the Opera song into Music of the Night, apparently they conceived a child. And this boy is that child. So she tells her son with glowing face, "This is actually your dad. Isn't that amazing? I'm going to die now and leave you with him." End of musical.
And then it turns into a dad comedy about, like, how am I going to raise this son that I didn't know I had?
The third one is just about him, like, yeah, like, it's a sitcom.
The Phantom and his boy.
Yeah. The Phantom's kid. Phantom Jr. there was another Phantom musical. We've talked about it a little bit, but it wasn't nearly as successful, obviously.
Or Yeston,
but
right?
I believe it's a little darker, Scott.
Yeah,
it's
that's what I've always heard, is that
it's a little less popera, which is what I would argue this is. This is like pop opera, popera. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little more musical theater, but it's like kind of gothic and darker. And I think it gets produced. I remember in Kansas City and around the Midwest, it like popping up here and there. Yeah. Y'all want to talk about the movie just a little bit?
I just have one hot take on the movie.
Yeah.
Gerard Butler is worse than Russell Crowe in Les Mis.
Is that a
His
hot take?
His singing is so fucking bad in this. Like, I was like, all right, Mr. 300. I don't mind Gerard Butler. His singing is so fucking bad in this, in my opinion.
Well, and he wasn't a singer. And
yes, he was.
Huh?
Yes, he was. He was the front man of a rock band.
Of a rock band, but he had
Russell
to go.
Crowe too?
But he went through 6 months of vocal training before he shot the film, and
there were a lot of other people.
And he was Gerard Butler at the time. He wasn't big.
He wasn't famous yet. No. No one knew who he was yet.
And it was like, if you're gonna do that, if you're gonna pull a Johnny Depp and put somebody into this well known musical thing, then either find a huge superstar that really justifies it, or find somebody who can sing like a motherfucker.
Who can do it well.
Yeah. I think.
Let's hear it.
I don't think he's like an amazing singer. I don't. I think the thing that the movie does that I think is most people's aversion to it is it deletes all of the opera unless it's literally the opera singers singing it. Everyone else is doing a poppy musical. Emmy Rossum is really going like, I mean, they even change the riff of Think of Me into this like weird pop riff. And you're like, okay, it's not fully pop like we think of it now, like Ariana Grande riffs, but it's, you know, it's 2000s pop. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I do really like what they do to beef up the soundtrack in terms of, and I was joking on it earlier, but they add a lot more sort of rock into the Phantom theme and a couple other places. There's a lot more guitar. There's a lot more electricity.
Maybe they do it more successfully here than they do in Evita, possibly.
100%. Yeah. And correct. The thing they do in Evita doesn't work. Here it does. It gives you a little bit more like, oh shit, The drum beat pad sounds are a little rough. But besides that, it's interesting. It's directed by Joel Schumacher, who did The Wiz. Movie and
St. Elmo's Fire.
He does the back end of the Burton Batman franchise. He did Forever.
He puts
Batman
nipples on the bat suit.
Nipples on the bat suit. He committed the.
He passed away pretty recently within the past couple of years, he was an interesting dude in that he was a protege of Halston's.
Sure.
The dress designer.
Yeah.
And then came into film through design, which you can see in he was the window arranger guy and then did all kinds of other stuff for him. But you can see, like, even in St. Elmo's Fire, which I think was his first or second movie, he does like some really interesting sort of framing of shots. And I did think that the movie had a lot of cool design flair that
they film in the Paris Opera House?
Yeah.
They did? I thought they did. Yeah, and that's cool.
It's cool. And I think the casting, delete Emmy and Gerard for 1 second. I think the casting of every single character, including Patrick Wilson, is spot on. Like there's no one who sticks out as like in the wrong time period or any, like the Meg is really good. The Madame Giry is really good. Minnie Driver, even though she's not the one actually singing, is hilarious.
But they did it smart there. They got an actual fucking opera singer to sing for her. Like,
which is smart. Yeah, yes. Exactly. But it really feels like Minnie the whole time. Like
she's great.
The voice is very similar. But my take on Emmy and Gerard is that Emmy Rossum is interesting casting. I think she sings it very well, and I think she acts it okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Gerard Butler, I think, acts it like an ass clown, a no-talent ass clown. Sings it good enough for me to get through the film and be like, sure, because I get what they're doing. However, I think he looks amazing in that fucking mask.
He's hot. He's like a hot beast
in Beauty and the Beast. And I almost wonder if they just saw him in the mask and went, well, just cast it. Who cares? We'll give him singing lessons.
Yeah.
They're just like, who cares? Because he looks hot. It was the first time I saw him in anything, and I was like, yo, Butler, who's this guy?
Come on.
I did want to mention, because it was one of the articles that I found that was kind of super critical of the grooming and all that.
Yeah.
He was 35 when they shot this, and she was 16.
Emmy? Was she 16? I thought she was like 19 or 20.
Yeah, she was 16 when they shot it.
That means she was like 14 when she was in Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
That can't be right.
I think
it's funny because the next thing that I really know her in is fucking Shameless, where, you know.
Or she's naked the whole time.
Everyone's doing really gritty, naked, hard shit on screen. So I saw Shameless
before.
She's
playing
before
Angeline
right
now.
Opera.
She's playing Angeline. The
is famous. That her? Oh, that's.
Yeah, that's her.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you saying, Siege? Sorry.
No. I saw her in Shameless before I saw her in Phantom, because I just watched Phantom for the first time a couple nights ago. So. That's just an interesting juxtaposition.
Anything else?
86. She was 18 when they shot it.
Oh.
Well, she was 18, Bailey. It's totally fine.
No, I'm not saying that. Again, though, I think it's a horror story. And I wish this musical actually allowed itself to go there.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't.
No, it
does that make sense? Like,
I feel like it pulls almost all of its punches.
Yeah,
like for all of our talk and this, we haven't talked about any themes, because I don't think there really are any themes on a literary dramatic level. So here's my big take. This is lowbrow entertainment that masquerades as highbrow entertainment.
Yeah, because you got to spend crazy amounts of money for a ticket.
Yeah, but so is Star Wars, right?
Yeah, but Star Wars isn't. Wait, no, Star Wars is
a space fairy tale. No, that's not. It's not that.
It's never to pretending to be highbrow. It is a pop movie.
Agreed. I think that's the difference. Except that I think the fans do view it as such.
Sure. I feel like...
And maybe that's my biggest problem. Maybe that's my biggest problem.
No, I'm saying Star Wars fans. Star Wars fans view it as not a poppy space.
Right, but Phantom fans do the same thing.
Well, I feel like with this movie...
I don't know a lot of Phantom fans.
Well, and I feel like in 2004 when this came out, kind of like Evita... Instead of like kind of having a viewpoint on it and trying to do something with it, it's like, hey, remember that musical everybody loves? We're going to do it on film. Because like I said, pretty much step by step in a lot of scenes, it's the exact same thing they do on stage.
Yeah. Bringing it to a wider audience. I mean, that's my argument for making films out of musicals always. Pete Buttigieg. I'm always a little bit like, sure, great. Like, except for things like...
Hopefully they'll do something else after Phantom of the Opera.
Right. No, for sure. Wicked is one where I'm sort of like, well, that has been touring for 1,000 years, mm-hmm. right? And like, we don't need a real Hamilton movie. They're doing that. They're making like an actual Hamilton movie.
Oh. Yeah, they don't need to.
I'm like,
do
we
that.
Don't need it. No. They're making another Little Shop. I'm like, we've been seeing that since the 80s, and there's already a movie.
But,
we don't need.
But
that kind
Wicked,
of thing.
Wicked is interesting because I'm kind of waiting for it.
I'm going to see it 500 you know, times but, in theaters. Just,
well, and but, it's an interesting take on an old story, too, you know?
Yeah, the hook on it. I mean, my only criticism, well, and I have a similar criticism about Phantom is it took them 15 years to make the movie. They tried to make it in the early 90s, and it was right. the weight took away stuff, and I think that's my fear about Wicked is like, this movie should have been done a decade ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why it took you so long to get the vision for what you're gonna do.
Yeah.
My last thought on the film is that I do think it, because of the poppiness and it's not operatic, it doesn't really work. Gerard and Emmy definitely like don't work mm-hmm. singing wise Siege like mm-hmm. to your point, because it's written to be sung operatically.
Mm-hmm.
And
I miss
but
my
it's
Michael
not like
Crawford.
Yeah, MC. We love Michael Crawford. Okay, yeah, we'll get into... Well, no, we won't. There's a lot of... There's been Sarah Brightman, Michael Crawford, fucking... There's been 1,000 Phantoms, 1,000 Christines. Everyone knows the musical well enough. Should we get out of here?
Yeah, we've been talking about this forever.
We've been going on.
Should we do another half hour on Solar Babies?
This is a long one.
Yeah.
This was fun. Yeah, thanks for indulging me, guys. I know this was kind of like an eye-rolling type of situation.
Yeah, I'm going to get you back because we're going to do Jodorowsky again.
It's eye-rolly, but I wanted to come in with defense because of how I spoke about Evita. And I didn't defend Evita at all.
Right,
and I'm
right.
like, hold on. Let me tell you why this is a musical that does... like, a lot of people do really love this musical. Mm-hmm. I don't know them. I don't know them. I know like one or two, right?
They're
I know
my
friend with the tattoo. And your parents. CJ's
yeah.
parents.
Yeah.
Joy Merriman lives for Poto.
Joy and Alan love this musical. Well, and I mean, it's been valuable for me as an individual to revisit this shit that were huge what for me when I was younger. And now it's like, I don't remember the last time I sat down and listened to Phantom of the Opera from top to bottom. It's been a really long ass time.
Yeah.
So it's been fun just to revisit. And
no, I'm glad I got to revisit it. And I did have some nostalgia flashes, but then my taste and intelligence brought me back.
Grown up a little boom, bit. I mean,
boom.
I bet if I went and saw it in theaters, like a literal theater, live theater, and it was grandiose and well done and well sung, I'm sure it would bring a tear to my eye at some point, and not for the fact of what is happening inside the context of the play,
but because of execution.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yes.
it is that to me where I'm just sort of just like, yeah, 120 people have to come together every night to put this up. You know, like it's like that's, I don't know.
It will come back to the Pantages and we will go see it.
And we shall.
We will.
With Scott.
So
we will force his eyes open.
Oh,
with needles,
yeah. We'll get
like
drunk.
Only if it's a union tour.
If it's non-union,
I'm not going.
No one's spending that kind of money on non-union tours. That's everyone just does hair on the non-union tour. Another basic musical, hair.
Yeah.
Let's do some spotlighting of Los Angeles theater. How y'all feel about that?
Good.
Yeah. Drop that mofo.
LA Spotlight.
The first thing I'm going to shout out is, do you have kids between the ages of 8 and 16?
No.
Sacred Fools is doing their 14th summer camp this July, but registration enrollment has just gone up. So if you have a kid between the age of 8 and 16, it's July 17th through 28th. Go to sacredfools.org and hit up those kids. Wait, that didn't sound right.
Hit them. Don't punch them.
Don't touch the children. But if you, it's
Speaking
wonderful.
Of grooming,
right? But Emily Kozlowski heads up the summer camp. She was on Broadway in Les Mis.
Whoa.
Yeah, so there we go. And she's just a wonderful person. Happening at the Ruskin Group Theater is Picasso at the Lapine Agile, which is a cool little play, and go see it. It's running through April 2nd. Ruskin Theater Group for more information. For the Love of the Glove is playing at the Carl Sagan Andrean Theater.
Isn't that the Michael Jackson musical?
It's the Michael Jackson
the
with
Pup.
Yep,
glove.
Yep. Yep. Okay. You got it. Okay. But check that out. Then what's the next big thing? Come Get Maggie is at the Matrix Theater.
Speaking of grooming, am I right?
Right? No. Okay, but it's Rogue Machine at the Matrix Theater.
But check. Saw some shit.
Oh my God. Oh my God. But come get Maggie is getting great reviews. Go check it out. And then finally, Christina Wong, Sweatshop Overlord is at the Kirk Douglas Theater. Check out centertheatergroup.org for more information. It is getting super raves, and I had three people come and go, it's so good. So check out Christina Wong, Sweatshop Overlord. CJ.
Gifted by friend of the pod, Bob DeRosa, is at Loft Ensemble opening Friday, March 10th. Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 7, loftensemble.org.
Gifted is a show that I produced
right
4 years ago?
Yeah, a show that we all know, and some of you better than others.
I was understudy in it, and it was a fun show. Bob
You're
DeRosa.
Doing it at the Loft. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And then finally, I just wanted to shout out, I went and saw One Axe somewhere this last Monday. It was their first outing, and it was sold the fuck out. It was a packed fucking brewery of a ton of just theater nerds drinking beer, brand new plays. It's coming back in April, and I just want to shout it.
You're not allowed, listeners. It's already.
I just want to shout it out because they're going to be taking submissions. So, like, if you have a one act that you want to try out, I will get more information on that. But One Act Somewhere is coming back in April, and it felt good being in a room full of people that were excited about theater. No. Yeah,
Let's do it. Let's do Basil and Dick.
Yeah.
All right. Mine are, I just have two. One is go support the play Annex, written by winner of the Theater Playwright Award Fringe 2022, Maddox Pennington.
Yes.
At MKP in LA on Instagram. You can support Annex the play, a play we covered that we discussed. It's being produced this year. I believe it's being workshopped, and then it's being put up at Hollywood Fringe 2023, which means it's potential for another nomination and win of the Playwriting Award. We'll see. But you can support and donate to help that move forward at Annex_the play on Instagram. Go check that out. And then also, I'm directing a 6-hour version of the War of the Roses Henry VI saga.
Yes.
Nice.
It is long and awesome and fun, and I highly recommend you coming out to see it. I will put details in the show notes because it's really specific. It's at this old Polish church in West Adams.
Ooh,
pretty
that's
cool.
Nice.
But it's long, and you got to come to see part one and part two if you want the whole story. So it runs next weekend and the next. It's like the 13th through the whatever. I don't know. I'll put it in the show notes. Go check it out. Henry VI, calling it the War of the Roses. Pretty excited about it. CJ and Scott are going to come, but they're going to be high, and it's going to be fun.
High as shit.
Join us, y'all.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us for part two, Phantom of the Opera, of Fantcast of the Podpra. Join us next week for part three, where we're talking about School of Rock, the great long told tale of Dewey Finn and the children of Horace Green. Did I pull that out of my ass? Is that right? Horace Green? Is that the name of the school?
I don't know. I think that's right.
I think I pulled it out of my ass. That was awesome. I don't know. Join us then. And then after that, what are we doing? Do you remember? Original movie musicals?
Is it? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm so excited for that too. Yes.
After Andrew Lloyd Webber, we're going to start covering we're doing one of our Pam miniseries. She's somebody who's written songs for us in the past. Oh, we didn't get an Andrew Lloyd Webber song from her.
Well, let's get it from her.
I'll talk to her. We'll get it. But we're covering a bunch of original movie musicals, musical movies that were not on stage first. So
I'm
have y'all thought about what
choice.
You're doing? Do you
yes.
know what you're doing? What are you doing, Siege?
I'm doing Rocket Man.
Oh, yeah. Sick. Yes. That'll be fun. Scott? Yeah.
Oh, I thought of it. Now I can't remember. Yeah. I'll get back to you.
I think Pam is doing Moulin Rouge.
Okay. Oh, fun.
We'll see. Obviously, Moulin Rouge was turned into.
Oh, I'm doing before. Oliver.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Oliver exclamation point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I haven't watched in a long time.
I'm going to double check you on that because I'm like 99% sure it was on stage before it was on.
It was not.
I'm going to double check you. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I haven't decided mine yet, but it might be one of the Muppet movies.
Okay. Oh, that's right. You were talking about that.
Yeah. Potentially Muppets Take Manhattan, but I might save that for a movies about theater.
Okay.
And we might just do a Great Muppet Caper.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll get there, but thanks for joining us. Bye.
Questions, comments, compliments, you can reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or via email. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
Bitch.
He also writes all of our stingers, and he's an amazing human being. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright, Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
And I'm Errol Binder.
You guys are my top girls. I love you so much. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. We'll see you later.
Let's go on a date.
Puerto Rico, you lovely island.
No.
Island of tropical breezes. No. Always the pineapples growing. Always the coffee blossoms blowing. And the money owing. And the babies crying. And the people trying. I'm trying not to do an accent. It's really fucked up. I should just stop. I like the island Manhattan. Smoke on your pipe and put that in. Oh, I just want to sound like Rita Moreno.
Later, everybody.
The theater. Theater.